This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the EDH Retcast. My name is Joey Schultz and I'm joined, as always, by my fantastic co-hosts. Up first, I've preordained that he'll ponder whether he should brainstorm. It's Matt Morgan.
So Joey, why do you have to spell dark with a K and not a C?
Because you can't see in the dark.
There it is. You've graduated. I'm so proud of you, Joey.
I have. I know how to dad jokes. It's a blessing and a curse. I don't know what to do with all this power.
Well, I would call you a dork, but you can't O in the dark either. You have to. You're, wow. You're dark.
Okay. Yeah, he does
there
not
it is.
Miss.
There it is.
He does not miss, ladies and gents. All right. Up next, he's opted to consider a careful study. It's Dana Roach.
Why aren't snakes bothered if you cast a Mind Slicer?
Goodness, why?
They don't have any hands to discard.
No.
Oh. Yeah, I guess. Dana, here we are in 2023.
Dana, you should become a welder because that was riveting.
That one delighted me, and that's the audience I most aim to amuse.
Well, yes. I'm sure all of our listeners are really glad to hear that anyway. This is the EDH Reccast. EDH Rec is the best deck building resource on the web for the Commander format, compiling data from decklists all over the internet to provide helpful recommendations for new Commander decks. And here on the podcast, what we like to do is give all of that data just a little more context. Matt, do you mind telling us what it is that we're talking about in this week's episode?
Well, I figured since we won't let you have any segues this year, we may as well give you an episode to transition into talking about one of your favorite decks. So I believe you have queued up for us Baba Lasaga, or excuse me, Baby Lasagna, not Baba Lasaga.
Yeah, we are finishing off our trio of episodes about some of our personal decks and how they differ from the data on EDH Rec and the interesting lessons that you can learn from, you know, closely examining decks and the, you know, what it says about the person who built it. And we're on to mine now, and we are talking about my gal Baba Lasaga, or because her name looks really fun to me, I also say Baby Lasagna because I am 12 years old. So yeah, we'll be talking about that for this episode, and I'm pretty excited to talk about my wonderful, wonderful Night Witch and how she eats all the things and make all my opponents lose life for it, and the lessons that hopefully are interesting to impart from the journey of building this deck. But before we get into that topic, we got some shout-outs to do.
First, I'd like to thank Chase, also known as Mana Curves. You can find them on Twitter at Mana Curves, and they are a ton of help in editing this show.
Mm-hmm. We're ecstatic to tell you that EDH Rec has also partnered with Coalesce Apparel and Design. Coalesce has an amazing line of Magic-inspired apparel, and if you've ever wanted EDH Rec shirts or hoodies, you can now go browse the EDH Rec collection. Head to Coalesce and use code EDHREC for 10% off your order. That's code EDHREC.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by liking, subscribing this video on YouTube, subscribing on your local podcast apps, or by going over to patreon.com/EDHRetcast, where we have patron tiers of all sorts of levels. Whether you want to join the Discord community, you want to see all the episodes a day early, all that and more over at patreon.com/EDHRetcast, including the weekly, the most coveted tier of all, the weekly shout out, which we are going to give this week to Hai Huang. So thank you so much, Hai. We appreciate all of your support. Thank you for saying hi, and we're going to say hi right back this week in the shout out. Nope, you couldn't avoid it. You softballed me that one. And Hai, thank you so much for all of your support.
We appreciate all of our patrons so much, and we also appreciate that they put up with the fact that Matt also finds opportunities to make dad jokes out of every Patreon shout-out, too, which is an art.
I think they appreciate that you two put up with me, and that's what they appreciate.
Awesome stuff. Okay, let's get into the topic here. We are indeed talking about Baba Lasaga, the Night Witch, and I will try to refrain from always saying baby lasagna, but she's my baby. She's my baby, and I absolutely love her. So I guess real quick, I'll introduce what this commander is, and then we can get talking about different lessons that were learned from the building of this deck. But let's just set the stage real quick, so I will dive right in here. I've talked about this commander a lot on this show, but it's become, I think, my new signature deck. Baba Lasaga Night Witch is a 3-mana Golgari 3/3 human warlock that can tap to sacrifice up to 3 permanents, and if there were 3 or more card types among the permanents that you sacrifice, each opponent loses 3 life, you gain 3 life, and you draw 3 cards. And I love this deck so much, and Dana, you're gonna have to contain me a bit in this episode because I get really giggly when I talk about all the fun stuff that this commander can do, because it's a lot of fun. And I hope that you've enjoyed playing against it as I become a little chaos gremlin every time that I activate that stinking ability.
I mean, there's never really any doubt about how much you enjoy this particular deck. Like you said, it makes you giggle. like me delighting myself with my own jokes. This deck clearly delights you. It is you are the target audience for your own deck in this case, for sure.
Because it's just so good, because it's a sacrifice outlet in the command zone. And, like, we've all seen how powerful sacrifice outlets are in this game, right? Being able to do that at any time, to put stuff into the graveyard, and you draw cards for it. And there are just so many fun synergies that I get to pull off with this deck by, like, turning things into lands, and then they have multiple types, and turning things into artifacts. And I get to eat different creatures that will go and find me stuff when they die. And it's just been a very, very fun deck to morph into as the Golgari player that I cannot help but be.
Well, and the crazy part about it too is in a world, in a format full of graveyard synergies and sacrificing things, this deck stands out for you, and you're kind of known not just on the show but just in general as I like to sacrifice things. It's like me turning things sideways and Dana paying life to draw cards. Like, everybody has their own little signature, and somehow this baby, it's funny that you say baby lasagna, because the art on the card is not young at all. It's very much old hag energy there. But yes, somehow Baba Lasaga stands out among all of that just entire field for you specifically.
Yeah, and what's interesting with the deck and the commander design too is a lot of times in sacrifice-based decks like this, you're very much encouraged to lean into kind of stacks-ish effects as your win condition, because that's just how sacrifice decks work, right? When you are like losing some amount of permanents, the way you then want to win is to turn that into something advantageous for you. Except for this deck doesn't necessarily need you to do that, because it's dealing damage to people and it's drawing you cards. It kind of has a baked-in way to still win with this deck and still play this deck without having to play stacks if you don't want to play it.
Yes.
And that's it's nice to have that path to be able to play a deck like this and not have to follow that same route that you kind of usually often have to expect to have to follow if you're playing some kind of a Golgari-based sacrifice deck.
Yeah, I don't need to have any of those Dictative Erebos kind of things to keep the field clear, because especially with this, I might not even end up sacrificing a creature with Baba's ability at all. And it really forces me to be as diverse as possible with the different types of things that I am playing. With that said, a lot of the win conditions that do tend to appear in this deck are pretty classic aristocracy stuff. Poison Tip Archer, Sir Conrad. I do love, you know, a whole lot of death means a whole lot of stuff that is going to hurt my opponent. So I'm not just relying upon Baba Lasaga's ability, but it is going to be a pretty familiar win condition for a lot of folks, with probably a little bit of landfall stuff thrown in there, because I will also eat my lands at a moment's notice. This used to be my Marin of Clan Nel'Thoth deck, which did have more of the Dictated Verbo stuff going on there, but that's actually a type of gameplay that I grew tired of pretty quickly, and I wanted to find something that was a little bit more proactive rather than just shutting down what my opponents were doing.
So when you turned this from Marin into Baby Lasagna, like how much of an overhaul did the deck have to do? Was this a situation where like basically you just kept the mana base and changed out most of the cards, or did a lot of this stuff carry over from the Marin deck?
Well, actually, it's funny you mentioned the mana base, because I think the mana base is one of the bigger things that changed, because because a lot of the stuff that I'll eat for this ability is stuff like Darksteel Citadels, or Artifact Lands, or Urza Saga, an enchantment and a land, Dryad Arbor, a creature that's also a land, because Baba Lasaga wants to eat things that have multiple types. If I animate a Mishra's Factory, and this is a synergy I've brought up on the show before, but like, hear me out, everyone, it's really cool. Like, if you animate a Mishra's Factory, it is now a creature, an artifact, and a land, and Baba Lasaga can sacrifice just that one permanent, and that's three card types, and then my opponents lose stuff and all I lost was one card there. So the mana base is actually, I think, one of the bigger things that changed, because now it's serving an entirely new purpose. My mana base is also part of, like, one of the biggest pieces of fodder that I end up chucking at my opponents as I eat all of that stuff.
Yeah, the cool thing, and Dana kind of hinted at that, is everything that you're doing with the deck, it doesn't feel oppressive, but it does feel unavoidable or inevitable. It's very much a Thanos, like, I am inevitable energy of nothing you're doing. Like, it, nobody ever feels you can't interact with it, because everything's on the board, but you're doing these things that you're going to find a way to get your value one way or another. And that's the cool thing about it, is you're finding different ways to add types two cards. You're doing a lot of artifact lands. You're doing a lot of artifact creatures, and all these different ways that you're finding ways to maximize the value. It's a very creative way, and you're just taking advantage of just Scryfall searches, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Oh, Scryfall was a huge help in finding things that were multi-type. So Ashaya can turn things into lands was a super big help. My favorite cards, like, ever right now, is like Liquimetal Torque is one of my favorite cards, just sort of at all. But it's even better here, because I can turn things into artifacts for the purpose of eating them. And so that I'm also going to play Liquimetal Coating in this deck for the exact same reason. And it's fun to turn things into enchantment and also artifacts and then eat them. And it's great. And so anything multi-typed or that can change types, those are definitely things that I loved paying attention to. And especially anything that repeatedly comes back on its own, like the card Rancor or Aspect of Mongoose. Those are enchantments that when they die, they will go back to my hand. And then Baby Baba's over here like, cool, I'm a snack on this multiple times over the course of this game then. And that's very, very annoying to everyone. I would apologize, but actually, sorry, not sorry.
I mean, putting Rancor into a deck, I'm never going to fall to trample on a keyword. Sign me up.
Well, one of the things I kind of mentioned a little bit when we did my show was how I had the basic idea, but it wasn't until I actually played the deck I realized how effective things like the pseudo ward that SCR granted would be to let me play kind of fairly aggro early on with my commanders, because they had built-in protection. Are there any things you discovered from this deck? So, like, clearly you saw Baba Lasaga and you were like, oh, well, this is going to be I can turn Marin into this. And I'm clearly had an idea how it would work, but are there things that you discovered about how the deck played that you didn't really realize until you actually like built it and got to play it and you realized, oh, this thing works really good in a way I really wasn't expecting?
I would say that the biggest hurdle that I had to learn with this deck is not to run stuff that costs like 6 or 7 mana. Because I, it turns out, am very ruthless. Like, I want to hit this ability every single turn, and that's not always super easy. Even if I am sacrificing just one thing, like just one Mishra's Factory, I'm still setting myself behind on at least one of my resources. Like, I will eat my lands to get this ability because I want to draw those cards. Like, you cannot hold me back. I am drawing those cards. But that often means that I'm usually getting to, like, turn 7 or 8 with only, like, 3 or 4 lands in play. So one of the bigger things that I had to work around was certainly finding a lot of the deck has to be like way, way lower on the mana curve. And that is definitely a different cadence than what I was used to when I was playing a Marin deck, where I would intentionally be running a whole bunch of 7 or 8 drops that I wanted to revive multiple times. This one is much more focused low to the ground. And so figuring out how it is that I'm going to make it into the late game with enough resources to keep playing and eating stuff was a big, big hurdle. And that changed changes a lot of the stuff that I wanted to play. Like, one of my favorite board wipes ever is Deadly Tempest, which is a 6-mana board wipe, destroys all the creatures, and then everyone loses life for each creature they lost. I really like that card. I would almost never have 6 mana to actually be able to cast that card when I needed to cast that card, because I ate a whole bunch of lands. So the value of being able to revive a bunch of lands from my graveyard definitely went way, way up, so that I could actually make it into the late game in the first place.
So what's a good question, I guess, then, I always like to ask, what is your favorite win condition in this? So we talked offline, we've talked online, we've talked on stream that you like that the deck can deal damage, but you don't have a really good way of gunning down one person. What is your favorite win condition in the deck?
I am probably, like, I don't know if this falls into pet card territory. It may not. But I was always looking for a deck, and Matt, you'll love this, that would play Blossoming Bog Beast.
Okay.
So Blossoming Bog Beast is a little bit like a Pathbreaker Ibex, but also not. It's Pathbreaker Ibex for life gain.
Adjacent.
Yeah. Like, when it attacks, you gain 2 life, and then all of your creatures get, they get a plus for however many life points you've gained that turn, and they get trample. And I was just like, okay, I kind of want to do that a lot, actually, because Baba gives me 3 life, and I can turn that with the Blossoming Boggies into like a +5, and that is really cool. But then one of these days, I also paired that up with a Zurin Orb, because I have some sacrifice synergies going on in this deck. And Zurin Orb, you can sacrifice a land to gain 2 life.
Ah, yes.
So I really, really enjoy having a Zurin Orb and a Blossoming Bog Beast in play with just a couple of other tokens, and yeah, I'll eat all of my lands, sacrifice every single one of them, gain 10 life or something like that, attack with Blossoming Bog Beast, and suddenly all of my creatures get a +12 and trample. It's the closest I ever come to doing the Matt Morgan signature swing style, and that is really fun.
Again, there's trample in the text there, so I am 100% on board with that. But yeah, I have been... I don't believe I was on the receiving end, but I saw it happen of you doing this. And this definitely inspired a little bit of hope in my heart for Blossoming Bog Beast. That card does a whole lot of work. And yeah, you are so reliably able to get 5 life pretty much every single turn whenever you attack with Bog Beast, because between Lasaga and Bog Beast itself gaining life, mm-hmm. It's very, very easy just to have this be a Beastmaster Ascension on a stick.
Yes. Yeah. I'd also say another fun win condition I've really enjoyed is Marionette Master, which I think we're probably all familiar with. Marionette Master, it has that fabricate ability. You can put +1 counters on it, or you can make servos. And when your artifacts die, you can start dealing damage based on Marionette Master's power. And that's really fun and all, but I love pairing that one with a Mazurek Kral Death Priest, where it gives +1 counters out whenever you sacrifice stuff, and just pumping up the Marionette Master even more, and then having Baba sacrifice a bunch of stuff willy-nilly to have Marionette Master just start mowing people's life totals down. That is also... I really like that, too. That's another fun moment for me. Not for anyone else, but definitely for me.
Well, in those two cards working together, too, it's one of those things that it's not the kind of interaction slash combo thing that most people think about when they think about things to be afraid of in a deck. So it's probably very easy to catch folks off guard with that combination as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, I think the primary way that you would expect this deck to win all of its games is very much through the aristocracy stuff that we're all used to. But just eating things isn't the only way that I hope this deck can win. Like, Mazurek on its own can also pump up the entire board to get really, really big. Having the ability to shift into combat as a plan B, I found it to be extremely, extremely helpful for this type of deck. Because dealing AoE damage, dealing just aristocracy damage, yeah, that's good. But I think a lot of people know how to shut it down. They know what to expect from there. So it's nice to have another thing that you can move into as a backup for that. And that's been an important lesson in switching this deck over. Because, like, I tell you what, my Marin deck never had that ability. But it's nice to see that Baba has a little bit more diversity in terms of which win conditions I can realistically pull off.
So one of the first cards I think of when I think of this deck is Ugin's Nexus. Because that's one of those cards I've always tried to find a deck for. And it's the perfect deck for Ugin's Nexus. and for those who don't know, because it's been quite a few years since this card came out, it's a 5-mana legendary artifact. If a player would begin an extra turn, that player skips that turn instead, which is, I guess, fairly useful. But if Ugin's Nexus is put into a graveyard from the battlefield, instead exile and take an extra turn after this one. So it's something that you can sacrifice to your commander as part of your draw three, gain three, dome people for three. And then you get an extra turn off of that thing.
You get an extra turn.
Yep.
That's and you have the sac outlet for it right there in the command zone.
Mm-hmm.
That's just ridiculous. This is like I said, it's the kind of card I've always kind of been looking for a deck that wants it, and this is just the perfect deck for it.
I mean, I'm going to steal credit for this one, actually, Dana, because I have this in my Vivictus Asmati, the Dire deck, when I get basically Chaos Warp something every single turn.
Yes.
This is fantastic, but I'm so glad and I heartily approve of you throwing this into Babala Saga, Joey. This is I love this card.
I was going to say full credit to your Vivictus deck. I learned it from watching you because you would destroy
Well, good, son. You learned it from watching Dad.
No, just Dad jokes. We're not Dad. No. It's just don't make it weird.
No, it's too late. It's already weird. It's been weird. Just admit.
Just embrace the weird.
That should be our tagline for this show. Absolutely.
Right. Probably.
But yeah, Ugin's Nexus is another one of those cards that absolutely surprises people. They're like, oh, wait a second. That does what now? And those are fun moments to elicit from an unsuspecting opponent.
Joey, do you know who Dean Kamen is?
No.
So he's an engineer that kind of is credited with inventing the Segway scooter. And in his honor, I thought this would be a good time to segue into Challenge the Stats.
Wow. You really went there.
I've been wanting to do that one for a while.
Wow. Okay. Well, here I was, thought we were having a nice time. But instead, Dana's just like, what if I stole all the Segways to Challenge the Stats?
I didn't know what was going on at all. And I'm oh my gosh. Thank you, Dana. Wow.
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, we can stop talking about me and my deck for a little while. We'll get to some more of your nitty-gritty questions later on in the show, but sure, fine. Let's move to Challenge the Stats, I guess, because Dana's a genius. Listeners, we'll be right back with some challenges, and I'm going to go evaluate some life choices.
It's not even a real person, is it?
Do you follow automotive news? Or do you just like cars and want to see what the heck's going on? Well, then you might like Donut Media's new podcast, The Big Three. Hi, I'm James Pumphrey, and every week, me and my co-host / two of my top five friends, Nolan Sykes and Joe Weber, unpack the latest and greatest in automotive news and trends on The Big Three. You'll also get a lot of laughs, hot takes, and personal insight on cars from the biggest car guys in automotive media. So, whether you're a hardcore enthusiast or just a person who goes, that's a good-looking car, check out The Big Three, available wherever you get your podcasts, or you can watch the full videos at Donut Podcasts on YouTube.
Well, I'll Dean Kamen my way into this first pick right here. So for those of you who have friends that are buying these starter commander decks, they're a great tool to help get folks into the format. It's not a super overwhelming deck. A lot of them, they've got some fun play to them, and there's definitely ways to customize, but there are some challenges there that I do want to make, even though, like I said, they're great tools to help get folks into the format. And one card that I absolutely love for Emara, Soul of the Accord, is the types of cards that give you free ways to tap and free, but also repeatable ways to get Emara tapped. One of those things that I love that I had a lot of success with when my Miri Weatherlight Duelist deck was all about getting creatures tapped was cards like Sentinel Stalwart. So Sentinel Stalwart is a single green mana. It says tap an untapped creature or artifact you control and add one mana of any color, and you have to tap Stalwart as well. So this keys in on Emara, Soul of the Accord's ability to, whenever Emara becomes tapped, you create a 1/1 white soldier creature token with lifelink. This is just such an easy way to get Emara tapped, start making tokens, but also you're generating mana. You're not doing something like with Glare of Subdual, where you're kind of doing a more defensive thing where you're tapping a creature you control to tap an artifact or a creature. This is a way to go about getting creatures tapped, but also you're generating resources and generating mana while you're doing it. And that's such a great thing because you don't want to spend all your time kind of spinning wheels, getting things tapped for minimal payoff. Cards like Sentinel Stalwart, and there's several of these out there. There's stuff like Springleaf Drum as well. They're just great little, not filler cards, but great ways to make sure that you're not sidetracking yourself with the getting Emara tapped ability, but also you're advancing your own game plan and you're not going too far out of your way to do that and get those bonuses. So it's very, very easy, I feel, to overlook a lot of the cards like Sentinel Stalwart, Springleaf Drum, all of that that get your creatures tapped, but also are generating mana for yourself. So I just want to make sure that folks know if you need just a 3-cent card to throw in there and help get bonuses for Emara, Sentinel Stalwart and the like are just great ways to go about doing that. I mean, you're playing a lot of creatures anyways in these decks, so leaning into creatures to do it is just a great way to go.
Nice one. I am going to move to my challenge now, and I have an interesting little number here called Bequeathal that I would like to challenge. Currently only showing up in about 2,200 decks or so, Bequeathal is a 1-mana green aura. When the enchanted creature dies, you draw 2 cards. It's a pretty innocuous little piece of work here, but I think this can actually pull a pretty decent amount of work in some certain decks. It's currently seeing the most play in a couple of Gruul commanders like Stang, Echo Warrior, or Kaima the Fractured Calm. Stang, for example, would duplicate the aura and then sacrifice it, so then you're going to get that draw trigger pretty reliably with Stang, and that's very cool. But I think this might also be a nice piece for decks that care about auras like Mazzy, True Sword Paladin, or Ivy Gleeful Spell Thief to repeatedly put onto enemy creatures or to copy with Ivy's ability, things like that. I almost want to say this. I don't know. Like, this is a tough thing to say. This could even, like, potentially be decent in Muldrotha decks, but, like, the issue with saying that is that everything's good in Muldrotha decks, and there's, like, 10,000 Muldrotha decks, but, like, this is a nice recurrable enchantment for Muldrotha too. But again, like, Muldrotha, everything's good in Muldrotha, right? So, like, what would you gut to even play this? But I don't know. I just find myself very charmed by this little 1-mana enchantment that will give you card advantage when the enchanted creature dies. There are a lot of commanders that play around in the aura area that I think would make great use of this little thing. It's some pretty nice card advantage, all things considered. All right. That is it from me. Dana, I guess we'll segue on to you.
My challenge this week was sent to us by a listener at Chittering Druid on Twitter. And the card in question is Viashino Heretic, which is a pretty good card in general that probably should see more play. In particular, Chittering Druid is suggesting it for Neheb the Eternal decks. Viashino Heretic is 2 in a red, and it has a 1 in a red activated ability where you tap it and destroy target artifact, and it deals damage to that artifact's control or equal to the artifact's mana value. Specifically, the reason he likes it in Neheb decks is the way Neheb works, you add red mana to your mana pool equal to the amount of life your opponents have lost during your second main phase. So you oftentimes have a ton of mana to burn. This gives you one outlet for it, destroy something your opponent's control to deal additional damage to them. Basically, you can use the mana during during your second main phase to activate the ability, or if you just don't have a way to poke damage through on somebody in your first main phase, you can use this to destroy an artifact and deal damage to them as well to get red mana in your second main phase. It's just very useful in general, but in a Neheb deck, the ability to use it either way, either as a mana sink or a way to generate the damage to get that mana, is really, really useful. It's only in 10% of Neheb decks. I fully agree it should see more play there for sure. It's an excellent card.
Yeah, mana sinks are always a nice way just to spend excess mana, and this is a good version of that. So yeah, that's a good call.
Yeah, very nice. Okay, we can move back to talking about the Babala Saga now. But I don't know, Dana has clearly shown that he's one of the most unpredictable monsters in the world. So I don't know where this conversation's about to go next, but well, bring it, Dana.
This is a deck we have to play against, you know, on stream on occasion.
Have to. So
it would be nice to know what the biggest weaknesses are of the deck. You know, just so we can help shore them up for you, maybe offer some suggestions.
Sure. It's a completely innocent question, I'm sure. No, this is
not self-serving.
Yeah, not at all. This, I think, is actually one of the bigger lessons that I think would be most interesting for listeners to take away from this deck, because I think I mentioned it before, but like, it is not uncommon for me to get to a late turn and for me to have only like 3 lands in play, because I have been eating all of my lands, just all of them. And if I don't find some type of splendid reclamation effect or a world shaper effect to bring all of my dead lands back into play so that I can actually play stuff in the late game, like, yeah, this deck has a very strong beginning because if I activate that ability once, twice, I've drawn six cards, I've gained six life, everyone is down to 34 life. It is a very big looking beginning, but I am certainly paying the price of longevity in order to get there. So finding a way to actually get the longevity for this deck is definitely a problem. And not only that, but like a lot of the cards that I do have in the deck are down in the like 3 mana or less range. So I don't tend to have too many late game powerhouses either because I can't play them very much if just given the way that the mana curve tends to go. So the late game finishing is definitely a weakness of the deck. I need to figure out a way for it to have a bit more late game punch because it tends to be pretty bombastic early, but then gradual after that. It has some diminishing returns that I need to fight through.
Yeah, one thing I've noticed about this deck, and I have the same problem with my Jahira Iron Throne deck that deals damage to everyone based on a thing I've done as well, is there's a lot of splash damage that you kind of can't control. And what I mean by that is, like, you'll find yourself in a situation where somebody else is ahead of the table and you don't necessarily want to take out the other two people because you kind of need them to either help take out the person who's leading or at the very least draw attention away from you.
Yeah.
But you can't really control that, right? Like if you were going to do your thing, it's dealing damage to everyone, whether or not there's someone you want to keep around or not. So I think that's probably a tricky thing here as well.
Oh, you have hit upon, and this is a deeply apolitical deck, which is a shame because I want to be political with, like, one of my favorite things to do, like Matt, let's say that Matt is casting a Reclamation Sage and I have a Liquid Metal Torque in play. Like, I can turn anything into an artifact so Matt can kill anything he wants. And those are the types of political shenanigans that I dream of. And it's so much fun on the very rare occasion that I get to pull off something like that. But no, you're absolutely right. Most of the time, I cannot move an inch without accidentally hurting every single person at the table. And that means that most of the time, those folks don't want to do a politic with me because, ow. So
yeah.
If someone's got 100 life and everyone else is at 3, well, if I want to try and draw cards to take down the person who's at 100 life, I will lose my allies because if I so much as budge, then my Poison Tip Archer is going to finish them off. My Babala Saga will finish them. Like, yeah, politicking is another very deep weakness of this deck.
Yeah, like I said, like I mentioned earlier, having so much inevitability, like you're going to take 3 damage pretty much every turn once Baba lands. So you may as well just get prepared for it because Joey's going to do Joey things. So speaking then of things that Joey do, so we're looking at some of these cards that you are and are not playing compared to the typical deck. So correct me if I'm wrong, but you have 31 cards unique to your Babala Saga deck compared to the average list on EDH Rec. So some of these cards that you're not playing, it's kind of hard to wonder. So you're not playing Life from the Loam. Mm-hmm. You're not playing Gloom Shrieker, 2 cards that seem to be at a lot of play in Babala Saga decks, but also Demonic Lore is another big one. Any insights on some of the cards you decided not to put in from the average deck?
Yeah, so Demonic Lore, that one, and also sort of related to it, Treacherous Blessing is another one. Those cards I have the easiest answer for. When those enter, you draw a bunch of cards and then they have some negative downsides. Like the Demonic Lore would say at the beginning of your end step, you lose 2 life for each card in your hand. Well, I mean, you can just play Demonic Lore, sacrifice it to Babala Saga, and then boom, you don't have the downside and you got 3 free cards. That's way awesome. The thing that I've noticed is that I'm terrified of ever playing that card if I don't have my Babala Saga in play. And since also she draws so many cards on her own anyway, that tends not to be a huge necessity for me. Life from the Loam, I would also probably categorize as that. Like, yeah, I eat a whole lot of my lands, but I tend to find a whole lot of them because of just how many cards I am drawing. So that doesn't, the card advantage the commander kind of handles all on its own. So I think that's the biggest answer that I've got for you. Gloom Shrieker, I think this one's a petty reason. Gloom Shrieker only gets back permanence. Like, it is an enchantment and a creature, but it doesn't give me back spells the way that a regular Eternal Witness would. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm just being... I probably should play it, but I think I'm just petty, because, like, if I want to get back a spell, I want to get back a spell. So, like, that one's just me being a little bit petty, which probably isn't a good reason, because so much of this deck is artifacts and enchantments and lands and different permanents still. But, like, I don't know. That one's probably just... it might be a habit holdover from my Marin days, is actually, I think, the answer to the Gloomshrieker one. But the others, I feel like I've got a good reason.
Well, and with Gloomshrieker, too, exiling itself instead of dying, I feel like that's probably a little bit of a knock against it too, especially with how many times and how many different ways you have to recur different cards in the deck. I bet that's probably a non-factor. Correct me if I'm wrong there.
Yeah.
As to why that specific card is also getting cut.
No, that's a good point. That does. I don't have a bunch of reanimation the way that I do with so many of my other decks, but I do have some, and I do. Yeah, there are little reasons that I look at Gloomshrieker and I just resent it a little bit. But with that said, it is still like, I totally get why people are playing that one for sure.
So this is kind of a general question about cards you're not running. Is this deck you found trickier than the average deck to kind of balance and make those cuts? Because, okay, so let's take your kind of average Golgari deck or whatever it is. You're, of course, going to want to have X amount of draw spells and some amount of removal and some amount of board wipes and some amount of, like, creatures in some amount of win conditions and whatever. But this is also a deck where, in addition to all of the normal things that you try to balance when you brew a deck, you probably also want to make sure you have a relatively even distribution of artifacts and enchantments and creatures. And, like, so you can have three of those things, and you can definitely double that up, you know, an artifact creature and then, you know, artifact land, whatever. But I feel like this would be much trickier than your average deck to have to make those moves. And I'm wondering, are some of the things you're not running because you're like, I can only run so many of this card type, and I need to run this thing that's maybe worse, but it also, like, checks some boxes. Is that something you encounter?
Very that. Yes. That part, yes. Trying to keep an even spread on the card types is the hardest part to juggle. But it is interesting to juggle those two different things at once, having a good distribution of removal and win conditions, and also a good distribution of stuff that I can eat. The trickiest part of the stuff that I can eat, for sure, is the enchantment loadout, because there are a lot, and I mean a lot, of artifact creature crossovers, but there aren't as many enchantment creature crossovers. Like, I find with this deck, it's very, very easy to have a random creature to sacrifice. And if I, like, a Memnite or an Ornithopter, boom, a zero mana artifact creature, that's two of my types. And then I'll just need, like, an enchantment or a land that I can have as the other thing to follow up to that. And I feel completely set in the Baba Potion feast that is about to happen. But there aren't as many. Like, there's only one enchantment land that I know of, for example, and that's Urza Saga. So this is very much a deck where if I make a change in the artifacts, well, how am I going to make up for that? Like, if I change the number of enchantments that I've got, that could actually be detrimental to my ability to play the deck, because then I'm forcing myself to always eat my lands. And my first draft of the deck didn't have a whole lot of enchantments at all, because I wanted to lean even more to some artifact sac synergies. And yeah, I was always eating my lands, and sometimes it's nice to have the option not to have to always eat all of my mana resources. So the short answer is yes. The long answer is yes.
That makes sense. Yeah. Because, like, there's a lot of great cards that I feel like would be good in this deck, but, like, looking at some of the lists of ones you're not playing or that you've moved over to your sideboard, I that's the first thing that made me wonder. Is, like, I wonder how much that is just a balancing issue versus the card. The card's probably good, but there's just some other considerations beyond whether or not it's good for this particular deck.
Yeah. Another thing that definitely comes up with this one as well is understanding the actual realistic timing of when I'm going to activate Babala Saga's ability. So, for example, there are some cards like Witch of the Moors or Silver Smote Ghoul, where those have triggers at the beginning of your end step. If you've gained life this turn, then they have some awesome benefits for you. Like, the Silver Smote Ghoul can come back for you. And that's really cool, but they only trigger on your own end step. And I kind of prefer to sandbag this ability a little bit. I want to be able to activate Baba at instant speed at the end of the turn before mine, for example, which means a Witch of the Moors or a Silver Smote wouldn't trigger at all. And that just makes, like, those cards would force me to always use this ability on my own turn. And I don't always want to use it on my own turn. Sometimes I want to evaluate a little bit to see what it is that I might need to eat in case there's a creature that I need to stick around or an artifact that I'm going to want to keep in play based off of something that Matt did, for example. So those are some other choices that I've made just in terms of not only the card types of the deck, but also the way that the timing of these abilities all tend to line up. And that is one of those things that I only could learn by actually getting some reps in with the deck, but they've been really important lessons for me to take away.
So Joey, everybody has, like we've talked about, pet cards, cards that you love to run. What's a card maybe that's overperformed in this deck that you didn't expect a whole lot from, but has kind of blown you away with how well it's been working out?
Ooh, sort of a pet card, you say?
It doesn't have to be a pet card. I mean, it's kind of in that ilk, but what's just something that has surprised you with how well it's been that you came out of the blue to surprise you with?
So I mean, in terms of pet cards, like some of the win conditions that I chose for this deck, like Titania or Mazurek, those are some of my favorite pet cards, but they also were very, very good for this deck because I'm sacrificing a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I might as well pump up my team as benefits for that. And they definitely impress me. I really like those. But like, I think if I had to go with like an underdog I didn't expect to love as much as I do, is actually the card Restore, which is a 2-mana green sorcery that takes any land from any graveyard and puts it onto the battlefield under your control. This hasn't historically been a very good card, but like I like stealing your utility lands because I don't have a lot in my own deck because I can't afford to run them because I have to run so many. These lands are also artifacts, or this land is also an enchantment and stuff like that. But I don't know. Restore has been kind of an MVP as a small way to be like, all right, I ate my Mishra's Factory already. Let's get it back and then eat it all over again so that I can activate that Baba ability with just that one thing. So yeah, that one has been fun. And occasionally it's kind of nice if someone happened to get milled or some other stuff died. It's kind of nice to steal someone else's Cabal Coffers.
I guess the commander staple that everyone's heard of, Restore, obviously, yes. Such a great card. I mean, it's funny how all three of us have found these random cards, like uncommons that nobody gives two hoots about, and we found these decks that just absolutely just thunder in the right situation.
Yeah, they're very fun. I'll also give some MVP shoutouts to cards like Instill Energy, which allow you to untap Babala Saga to use it multiple times a turn, which is hard to activate her multiple times a turn, actually, because then you're eating a lot of stuff, but it's still great. And I also really like Kaya's Ghost Form as well, which is a 1-mana black aura, enchant a creature or a planeswalker you control, and when that permanent dies or gets put into exile, you return it back to the battlefield under your control. So I can eat the Kaya's Ghost Form and the creature that it's attached to, and that creature will come back, and that covers some types, and like Baba can eat herself and then come back right again for the feast, and this is also just good protection against like a Path to Exile or stuff like that. And for a little 1-mana common, I'm also very impressed by the amount of work that Kaya's Ghost Form can do.
Cosign, I enjoy Kaya's Ghost Form a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a good card in general, and the fact that it has so much added synergy in this deck is ridiculous.
I feel like Matt was asking me that question because he wanted me to talk about how good Arachnogenesis is, and that's why it's in my deck.
It's also kind of hard for me to say that a nearly $40 card overperforms in a deck, though, because yes, it is the best fog of all time and just one of my favorite cards of all time because you can just pocket sand somebody. But it's hard to say a card like that. The card that consistently overperforms. Yes, I would say Cyclonic Rift has exceeded expectations. No, nobody does that.
Yeah, no, I would say a lot of the stuff that has impressed, even like little cards like Viridian Emissary or Primal Druid, mm-hmm. like those are creatures that when they die, they go find me a basic land. Like some of the genuine MVPs in this deck are my commons, not even the rares. Like this is a deck that cares a lot about those things that are a little bit low to the ground. And that's another, I don't know, that's been a fun takeaway for me is that sometimes I don't play tutors in this deck, but if I did have any tutors in this deck, I bet some of the cards that I find first and foremost would be those little 1-mana, little ankle biter type of cards, because that's how important they are to this strategy. So, it's not all about the big and the splashy stuff. The actual core of the deck is full of a bunch of low to the ground kind of things. And that's a very important thing to keep in mind when we're playing the format that's all about the stuff that is always big and splashy.
Yeah, having cards that replace themselves seems very important and valuable for this type of deck, yes.
Now, I'm kind of curious to hear from each of you guys, like when we interrogated Matt's deck and when we interrogated Dana's deck, we made suggestions for different things that maybe those players would want to try out in their decks. Have y'all done the same for me? Are there some critiques of my deck that you cards that you think I ought to give a second look?
So the one that kind of popped up at me when I was looking through your list And it's a card I'm a fan of in general, but this feels like it's good in a lot of decks, and that's Prototype Portal. Four mana, and you imprint an artifact on a Prototype Portal, and then you can tap it and spend mana equal to the imprinted thing's mana value and make a token copy of that. It's a fun card to use in a deck where you're running artifact lands anyway, because the kind of the dream is to put a Dark Seal Citadel underneath it, and then every turn just ramp out a Dark Seal Citadel for zero mana.
Amazing.
In this particular deck, you already have five artifact lands. So there's a decent chance you can put any of them underneath it, and that's going to give you something you can sacrifice that's already going to hit two of the three checkboxes you want to sacrifice to your commander. But like, even if you don't have one of those lands, you've got, you know, three or four zero-drop artifacts in here. You know, I think three one-drop artifacts in here, two or three one-drop artifacts. Like, there's if you have to resign yourself to putting a Soul Ring underneath Prototype Portal, like, that's pretty good, even if you're not going to sacrifice those Soul Rings. So I just feel like this deck has a lot of stuff that will be pretty decent to put on a Prototype Portal and get some value off it, and then have it be available to sacrifice, even if you don't happen to hit a land. And if you hit a land, that's fantastic. So this is a deck, I think, that would actually really excel with that kind of card. And you usually don't expect to see that in a Golgari deck anyway. So that's one I might like want to see you give a test to.
Wow. I'm about to make so many treasure vaults. You have no idea.
Right, exactly.
The number of Ornithopters will be too dang high. That is like,
oh, gross.
That's a very interesting suggestion. More stuff to eat. Okay. I am doing me a think.
So how about you, Matt? What's your suggestion here?
So I've been kind of brainstorming. The more that I think about it, there are cards that I would love and I would probably put in my own version, because stuff like real dorky stuff like Suchi Cave Guard from Brothers War, mostly because
card. You just made that up.
It is. So inspired by Suchi, the old Antiquities card. But the Cave Guard, when it dies, you get eight colorless mana and it doesn't empty as phase's end. Like, something like that. Like, that seems hilarious for an artifact creature to sacrifice and propel you forward. But I also understand with this deck setup, Joey, like you said, you're not going to get a whole lot of land. So stuff like Field of the Dead that you're not playing, you're never going to have Field of the Dead turned online anyways. So why even try? So the card that I'm torn between two cards. One is Scrap Trawler, but everything is so low to the ground, I'm not sure how much value you would get.
Sure.
And also how long it would stick around. But I think Scrap Trawler would be fantastic here. But the card I really want to challenge is a card that we talked about for my deck that I've love in my Raga Draga deck, which is Llanowar Loamspeaker. So that's the card that it's a mana dork by itself. It's a 1/3 that can add a mana of any color, but you can tap it to animate a creature and have animate a land, turn it into a 3/3 elemental creature with haste until end of turn, and it still is a land. So you're able to turn some of these your Tree of Tales, that's normally a artifact and a land, turn it into a creature. So you're back to that synergy that you love so much in this deck, where you're only sacrificing one permanent, but you're getting all three permanent types checked off from just one card. So stuff like that, I think, is fantastic. Plus, I mean, surprise blockers. There's all sorts of different synergies. You're playing a Shaya, Soul of the Wild, to kind of do the reverse of this. But I think being able to animate any given land, especially if you're playing the artifact's land that is indestructible, Dark Moss Bridge, that's the one I was thinking of. You get an indestructible 3/3 blocker. That's fine right there. Same with Dark Steel Citadel. So there's a lot of different fun synergies you can weave in and out with Llanowar Loamspeaker. I think I shouldn't be telling you this, actually, because you're just going to use it against me if you decide to put it in your deck. But I love Llanowar Loamspeaker. I have a feeling this deck might maybe perhaps enjoy it too.
I learned it from watching you again.
Yeah, maybe. There it is.
Yeah. Well, and that's the animating of lands is certainly a signature aspect of this deck. And the eating of lands is definitely a thing I do a whole lot. And I think that is also one other lesson that that has been a bigger thing for me to learn with this deck, with playing any Aristocrats deck, but especially this one, because like, I feel like a thing that I've learned about this one is to just play it ruthlessly. Like, or even if I don't want to say it ruthlessly, like, be willing to take a leap of faith with this kind of thing, because I will frequently sacrifice a bunch of things. And I'm not necessarily always certain if I'm like, I'm going to eat a whole bunch of lands, whether or not I know if I'm going to get a world shaper to bring those lands back to the battlefield. But the only way that you'll draw down to find cards that are good, cards that will help you recover, is if you start eating all of those lands in the first place. So this is very much a deck where I feel like it's important to actually like be willing to try something a little bit risky. This is a strategy that reminds me a bit of like the decks that play with life loss, like my old Greven deck, for example, which the more life that you lose, the more powerful this thing becomes. I also feel that way about this. The more stuff that you're willing to eat, the better off your late game is going to be when you can finally find a way to bring a lot of those things back. But you have to be willing to actually do those sacrifices in the early stages before you know what the end game is going to look like. And so, yeah, if you're playing this deck, don't be too cautious with it. Take a lot of risks. I think that's an important lesson for Commander players to take away, because a lot of the decks that we tend to see out there, a lot of the value engines, play it a little bit more safe. They know exactly what type of value engine that they're going to do, and they don't want to lose all of their stuff. But this is a deck where you should be willing to lose your stuff in order to make big plays later on. And yeah, that's just a lesson that I hope is useful for folks out there.
Yeah, it's having a way to do the fun things and take risks. That's absolutely one thing that I know I just my mindset leans away from. And so I've had to push myself a little bit into doing that with my own decks. That is absolutely a great piece of advice for all deck builders out there. Just take risks when you're learning how to play a deck. That way you'll know what not to do in the future.
Now, I've kind of found like doing this little investigatory, like a little introspective look at our own decks. That's been really fun, looking at the ways that you guys interpret Magic and the way that I interpret Magic and seeing how different they are. I feel like for me, that taking risks idea is definitely one of the things that this deck reveals about me that I think is very fun. There's a riskiness and a resilience here. Like I'm gonna keep bringing back this stuff and I will make strange plays, but they might pay off in the future. And if they do, it's going to be glory. Like those are the things that I get to see that I have a bunch of fun with. Whereas Matt, with your Raga Draga stuff, you got to see some very clever stuff that was all in service of the combat step. And it spoke to just like gleeful delight. And with Dana, we got to see these like a little bit off the wall, unusual for these colors, with a strategy I thought I was familiar with and an unlocked different ways to access a strategy I thought I knew very well. And it turns out he's transformed my understanding of that. Like these have been fun episodes to do, to see the different ways that we each interpret the game. And so I appreciate the investigation into my deck here. And thank you so much for going on this journey with me. I hope we've all learned a lot about each other.
Well, I think it's definitely, and I think it's also a useful exercise, particularly, you know, someone like us who have all been brewing decks for a long time. It gets very easy to kind of wind up in a rut of doing the thing that you do. Like even if your thing is maybe unique, it's still your thing, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it is useful to kind of force yourself to look closely at someone else's deck and their thought process. It then makes you re-examine your own, I think is useful, because I think newer brewers tend to do a lot of like asking of questions about their deck or asking for advice. So they just wind up getting those perspectives in a way that maybe we don't, because we've been building so long, we just do our thing. So yeah, I do think this is a very useful thing to do for all kinds of people at all stages of the game.
Yeah, getting set in your ways is definitely something that you need to break free every now and then of. Getting feedback and just picking the brain of people, maybe not smarter than you, but just that think differently than you even, mm-hmm. is it such a fantastic way to do that, digging into and just sitting with your friends. Okay, how do you do this? I find somebody that you admire that builds really cool decks at your game shop. Pick their brain, like, oh, how do you figure out how to put X and Y cards into your deck? How did you come about that? And just understanding how other people do things and then applying it to your own deck building process, that's one thing. All three of us, like we've said, have done throughout the course of the show, and it's come to reflect in our own deck building processes afterwards and then spread to our own play groups even. And so it's very, very cool to get these dives and just pick each other's brains and go into depth about what are you doing that I'm not doing and what can I learn from it. That's just, it's such a fantastic thing that we do in professional settings too, and we get to do it here too.
I really like that lesson a lot, Matt. I think a lot of especially very enfranchised Magic players are perhaps a little bit more used to the dynamic of them being the person who someone comes to for advice. And sort of like you were saying, not everyone knows how to do it all. I'm very familiar with Aristocrats. I don't know the combat step all that well. I don't know her, but you know it very, very well. And for me to enter in...
Oh, she moved in with me. That's
yeah, exactly. But for me to enter into some type of deck construction or something, I'm bringing a certain amount of Golgari baggage in with me about how I expect certain things to go. And I need to be a lot more understanding of my usual understanding of how card advantage works might be related to how many things I tend to sacrifice, for example. And that's different than Matt's relationship with card advantage, where he's got a whole bunch of creatures on the board that he has to use those creatures in order to draw cards, and he's got to keep them alive in order to win the game. And I'm not used to that at all. So flipping that script a little bit, instead of being the person who someone comes to you for advice, you going out to investigate what other people are doing to learn from them, as opposed to being the person who folks come to, that is the way that you will be better at being able to give advice, is if you've done more investigations with other folks' stuff to see how it is that they think, because the only way that you're going to learn is by doing. And sometimes you can't make all the decks, but other people have lots of decks, and you can learn a lot of very strange, small, intricate things from those decks, and they say a lot about the people who built them. So yeah, Matt, I really appreciate that goal of learning from other people, because there's a lot of wisdom that we don't all have access to just yet.
Well, Joy, that point was so good. Dean Kamen is currently scooting across the internet to let you know that we're segueing into the outro joke. I don't know who Dean Kamen is, but Dana says he's a real person, and that means we're getting a real segue to leave the show on.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. This is the price that I pay for learning how to dad joke properly. Is that
this is the price you pay? I hope that the YouTube has just Dean Kamen on a Segway scooting across the screen. 100%.
Okay. Well, yes. Yeah. Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this little visitation of our decks. And we hope that there are lessons for you to learn from other deep dives into decks out there as well. They're definitely very interesting exercises to see how your decks differ from the data and what you can learn about it from there. But yeah, let's call this episode to a close. Fellas, if our listeners would like to get in touch with us to ask about different Segway-tastic things that you're going to steal from me, where is it that they can find you online? Matt?
So you can find me on the Twitter at Mathimus55. That's MathimuS55. And don't forget, Wednesday evenings, we are streaming over at twitch.tv/EDHRetcast. We have guests on every single week, and it's always a super fun time. So make sure you tune in for that as well.
And Dana?
You can find me on the Twitter birds at Dana Roach. You can hear me on my other podcast, at least for a few weeks longer, CMDR Central. I'm writing articles for EDH Rec, and you can find all of us together at patreon.com/EDHRetcast.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz on the onlines, and you can find the cast at EDHRetcast. Plus, if you've got a question for us, you can contact us at EDHRetcast@gmail.com. Our thanks go out once again to Chase for assisting me with the post-production of the show. You can find them online at Mana Curves. Listeners, we'll be back at you next week with more data and insights, but until then, remember, EDH wreck your deck before you wreck your deck.